Second day of our hearings in the House Judiciary Committee on the issue of extraordinary expenses in indigent defense. This will be our concluding day for generally discussing the subject matter, although we may have some further committee actions later that we'll take to address this. To bring everyone up to speed, because some of the members of the committee had to leave earlier yesterday for commitments, and I appreciate those members who stuck it out with us until 4 o'clock. We were able to complete, as I recall, discussions of the Jones, the Guzik, the Harned, the Simpkins, the Monzo Hernandez, and the State versus, and it says Cannon on 14, but it's Gannon. And those were the, I don't think we ever did McKnight. Okay. We waited on the McKnight case. So those are the cases that we were able to complete discussion on yesterday. So we're going to, we understand that some of the district attorneys are in a meeting that won't adjourn until probably after 2 o'clock. So we're going to try to accommodate everybody's schedule. So that will mean we'll wait on the Garner case for further discussion. And I just remind everybody the ground rules that we laid out yesterday, which is we're really here to talk about this issue of extraordinary expenses, and that's what we want to focus on in our discussions on the cases. So if you can do the best you can to sort of educate us briefly about the subject matter of the case and narrowly in more detail about the concerns about the extraordinary expenses, that's how we'll proceed. So, Ann, do you have a suggestion on where we start on the list today?
Mr. Chair, Ann Christian from Indigent Defense Services Division for the record. And I would suggest that we do the Calvin Davis case, which would be next after...
Okay, after Simpkins. So at that point, can we start to run down the list as it's listed? Can we do Davis, Cox, and Miles at that point?
We have defense counsel and the prosecution.
On all three of those cases?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, that's how we'll proceed then, is we'll do Davis, Cox, and Miles in that order. So without further ado, recognizing, by the way, happy Valentine's, everyone, and happy Oregon's birthday, and hope you had a chance to participate in some birthday activity here in the Capitol today. So with that, we'll go ahead and call up the folks on the Davis case. And the prosecutor in Davis
is Norm Frink, Mr. Chair. So.
Oh, and Norm's not here.
I just got a fact.
Yeah. Okay, how about the Cox case?
Actually, Chairman, if I may, I know that Mr. Norris made a request to jump ahead
because
he has to get back to the executive meeting, so I'm having trouble going first, and I'd be more than happy to go next.
That would be great. And is that the McKnight case? Yeah, then please feel free to come forward. We truly are trying to accommodate everybody's schedules and don't know quite who's got what from... the sheet we've got in front of us. So let's go ahead and move then. That's number 15 on the agenda list, State versus McKnight. And Mr. Norris, thank you for being here and appreciate you letting us not do you last night so we could do this today and let everybody get to their other meetings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney in Malheur County, Oregon. I want to talk to you a little bit about what I saw as a failure in evaluating the cost and benefits in the State versus McKnight case. In our work, we frequently have to make choices about what is the economic cost of having a particular test or witness called versus the potential benefit. In this case, the defendant came to my county to buy meth because he was selling it over in Harney County, brought his wife's daughter, and his wife's son with him. He ended up buying the meth, and his wife ended up in our local hospital. And the hospital...
Excuse me, I didn't hear you. His wife ended up...
His wife ended up in the hospital with some medical complications.
Okay.
The hospital ended up putting him in a charity situation where they paid for a hotel room while they helped the family. While he was in that hotel room, he raped and sodomized his 12-year-old stepdaughter. Now, this is a 12-year-old who is about 6 years old in the way she functions. And as so often the case, we didn't hear about it from the little girl until about a month, 2 months later out of Harney County, when the defendant's father raped and sodomized this same little girl. When we found out about it, we had a good witness. We had her little brother who said, yeah, I saw Dad get in bed with her, and I saw the motion and described as a small child would, someone having sex in a hotel room when you're there. And we thought, should we do DNA? We talked to the victim. You know, these people don't have a lot of money. She didn't have a lot of clothes. What she had had to be washed and sent to school with her. Realistically, the underwear she was wearing when she was raped and sodomized by her stepdad had been washed a dozen times or more. And even before the horrific cuts in the crime lab, which you're all aware of, as a prosecutor, I couldn't justify the cost of a DNA test for the potential benefit, because there was no way humanly possible that we were going to find DNA. Mr. Perez did give me the courtesy of sending a copy of his affidavit, Mr. Rader's affidavit, describing why they sought DNA. By the time they finally contacted me 6 months later and asked me, does the little girl still have the clothes, they had to tell me why, because they were asking me to contact a victim and get a personal property item from her. It was one of the very few times that I had a glimpse into the extraordinary expenses, because most of the time it's ex parte. And I made it very clear to Mr. Perez that I viewed this as a tremendous waste of state resources. And I'm proud that Mr. Perez and I are friends, but at a professional level, I let him know on certain terms that this was a waste. But I don't get a voice, as Mr. Rader so properly pointed out in his affidavit, in making defense strategy. That is their strategy, and I should not interfere. But I certainly should point it out when it comes out in a situation like this that they didn't do a cost-benefit analysis. In the affidavit you have from Mr. Rader, he says that he has an expert that would say that DNA will survive washing. Maybe. But very, very few times will it survive washing, and certainly not the number of washings that they were aware of over a six-month period. And yet, they got Indigent Defense to pay for a DNA test, which helped no one. If they would have found the defendant's semen in this little girl's underwear, who would that have helped? I'm assuming it would help the state quite a bit. They say it was to get the defendant in line so that maybe he'd plead guilty. Well, there are only three people in the world who knew what happened in that hotel room. That little boy who was too small to understand really what was going on, that little girl, and the defendant. He didn't need to have a DNA test to know what he did. And since he's convicted by a jury of his peers, it's not alleged rape. It is a proven fact that he raped and sodomized that little girl. They spent the money, and in the affidavit, you're told that it was inconclusive. DNA is not inconclusive. It's a yes or no answer. It either is the defendant's biological material, or it's not the defendant's biological material. If you have a sample that you can test, it is inconclusive when there's not a sufficient sample available to make a test and determine whose biological material it is. And that's exactly what happened here. It was inconclusive for the very reasons that I did not use state resources to do a DNA test. And what I'm hearing over and over again in this hearing and from the Indigent Defense, and they believe me, they do great work, and I don't want to see them cut at all. I just want oversight on how they spend the money so it's spent properly, is that I have real limits for the justice I provide to an 8-year or a 12-year-old girl who's raped and sodomized, and I make tough choices, but the defense has a blank check when they make those same choices, and they do not have to do a cost-benefit analysis.
We have Mr. Rader's affidavit in front of us that was distributed to us today. And are you going to be responding, or is it simply the affidavit that's going to be act as the response?
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a few comments, especially due to the reference to the blank check and my thinking with when I was presented with the request. And I believe Mr. Rader's affidavit speaks for itself as far as the defense standpoint, and I'm not a defense attorney. So I'd like to, I've only testified on two cases now. One was on the Gannon case that was out of Coos County, and that was one of the last ones you heard yesterday. And I did speak with the district attorney afterwards. To the point, in the McKnight case, what occurred is I did receive, per normal, an affidavit from the defense attorney. That affidavit requested, and I do have the attorney's permission to talk about this, did request 10 hours authorization for a contractor we have, which is Intermountain Forensic Lab in Portland. We have a contract with that lab to do forensics work and DNA work at what is a reduced rate compared to individuals out there practicing in private practice. And so that contract provides for both DNA testing and forensics. The attorney's affidavit, in my estimation, was insufficient, and I issued a denial with regard to his request. And always on denials or issues on which I have questions, we put in big, bold type, you know, that this is insufficient, and if you wish to submit a supplemental affidavit, we'll consider it again. But for now, it is denied. And about 3 weeks later, the junior associates submitted an additional affidavit to me. I believe there were conversations on the phone, and what I did is I went ahead and I did authorize it. Those are the facts. And indeed, Intermountain Forensic charged the state of Oregon through their contract $729 for this. This points out a difficulty with having the ability to get inside the case with the resources that we have. And so I do say that I authorized it. It was not on the first request. I obtained additional information from the attorney. And there appears to be a difference as so many of these instances turn out. And in the aggravated murder cases, I have not been asked to comment. But when it comes to scientific issues, there is still, even though the DNA research and things have been improved, there is some difference in opinion between the prosecution and the defense. I would like to just say there is not a blank check. The prosecutors may feel that way, and I'm not going to get into the debate about they have the state crime lab and they have the state hospital, they have state resources that are available. And I can say, much better than I could in 1991, which is what I mentioned yesterday. We had all of the circuit judges making decisions, say, on the DNA, on the other matters, that we would have perhaps 168 approaches to this. So, again, based on my initial testimony yesterday, the commission, the new commission that will be taking over, and I are perfectly open to improvements in the system. But in this case, and I live by my decisions, I did deny it initially. I was provided additional information, which Mr. Rader does set forth with regard to what the defense thought might happen is the client might accept a negotiated plea. And that gets into another topic that when Mr. Marquis gets here, if it comes up, is polygraphs as well. So I'll save any further comments until then.
Okay. Questions for either of them on this case?
Okay.
Floyd?
Mr. Norris, could you just give us dates of when this all was taking place? I didn't catch those if you gave
them
to
us. I can give you time frames. I don't have the dates, and I did write it in a letter. I don't know if you had it. The child reported a month or two after the event to law enforcement, and it was over 6 months later that the defense made the request to have the DNA done.
I appreciate that, but do you have a year, month? I'm just trying to get a conceptual as to other cases that we've heard.
This case just resolved itself at jury trial 3 months ago, and so we are talking about the winter of 2002 is when the rape and sodomy occurred. And this, the disclosure would have been approximately the spring, I believe. Am I right?
Yeah.
2001.
Mr. Chair, I have from Ogen. The case was filed January of 01.
Okay.
No, that's his. Okay, yes, you're right. That is the case.
I'm sorry.
So the events would have occurred
maybe in 2000.
We'll get this right jointly. The incident date was January 3rd of 01. And
you.
He was actually charged May 10, 02. The request came to me, the first affidavit came August 20 of 02, and the second request, I believe, came on September 13.
And I'm not sure those OGEN dates are right. I think the incident date is 1-3-02.
Oh.
Because this was not that old a case.
It wasn't an 01 case.
I don't believe it. Yeah. What is it?
From the incident date. That would be well over a year.
Oh, the case number is 02.
The case number is 02.
Okay.
Filed in May.
Representative Anderson, Representative Ackerman, and then Representative Shetterly.
Ms. Christian, you mentioned that there are expenses that the district attorney has, crime investigation, I guess, and several others. Does the defendant have access to all of that information?
To all of, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, is your question, does the defense have access to the state crime lab?
Yes, and any other investigation that the district attorney has done.
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. The law permits defense attorneys, I believe, we'd have to ask the defense attorneys to use the state crime lab, and they can better address the issues that are presented by that. I can say that at least during three sessions, since 1989, early in the session, there has been an interest in having defense attorneys use the state crime lab more than they do. And there's some provision in law for some protection because there can be some confidentiality issues. Yes. But during those three meetings, Representative Parks was the first that had a work group on it. There could never be, and it wasn't the defense attorney's consensus as far as how to better accommodate that. I know some attorneys who have used the crime lab.
And follow up?
Yes.
And vice versa, does the prosecutor have access to all of the information that the defense attorneys are investigating?
Representative Anderson, we do not unless they end up putting the expert on the witness list. They're free to get the work done, and if it's not to their advantage, then it's protected by work product and we would never find out about it. If they intend on calling the expert as a witness, the discovery rules do require that they make a copy of the report available to us.
Okay. Thank you.
Where was I? Was I Representative Ackerman and then Representative Shetterly and then Representative Barker? Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. I was Christensen. On the supplemental affidavit that you relied upon, did it contain just the representations of counsel, or did it contain representations that could be attributable to the expert that it was probable that DNA would be discoverable under these circumstances?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, my memory, and I did look at it yesterday, is that it was representations of the attorney only that did indicate that he had spoken with Intermountain. It did not say that Intermountain necessarily said that it would be conclusive or testable.
So the expert was not named. Is that what you're telling us?
The expert to be used, Intermountain Forensic Labs, was named.
He was named.
Okay. Thank you. And that expert is under contract with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Shetterly, then Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just sitting down when I heard, and I want to make sure if I heard correctly, something to the effect that since he had been convicted by a jury of his peers his guilt had been proved and you didn't need DNA evidence? Was that what I understood?
No, okay. That's not correct, Mr. Chair.
What was the statement, do you recall?
The statement was, I referred to the defendant as, my premise was he was convicted of rape and sodomy, and accordingly I was very comfortable saying he raped and sodomized his little girl. It was no longer an alleged crime, it was a crime. In any case where it's possible to get DNA, as a prosecutor, we want DNA because it takes away the uncertainty. This is a case where there was no reasonable chance that DNA evidence was going to be recovered under the circumstances, and yet the defense was able to do DNA at state expense, even though I could not justify spending that resource as a prosecutor. And they got the result that we all expected they would get. They got nothing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Shetterly, in part, a request would be for the purpose, I believe, and there are people who disagree with me, for the purpose of trying to reach resolution in the case other than a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is this matter did go to a jury trial,
yes, it
was
did.
It? And again, this is no comment whatsoever toward prosecutors, but in this case, there were a total of 10 charges, and the individual was convicted of 3. I don't think that honestly had anything to do with DNA evidence,
no,
and I would never try to represent. But negotiated pleas save money compared to jury trials.
Mr. Chair, I know in the dark ages when I did a couple of these criminal defense cases on an appointed basis, that was back when I used to do that, you know, I'd just throw the poor guy to anybody. We would do polygraphs for that very same reason, basically to say, okay, you are too lying, now let's get serious. That seems to save money if you can do that at the front end and
Absolutely.
Establish to this person that they really should not be going to trial on this thing and perjuring themselves and asking other witnesses to do the same thing.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's clear, in this, at least from this affidavit, that the person, the defense attorney, thought the guy was guilty and was going to try to use that evidence. If that evidence had come back that it was his DNA in there, the guilty parties, would that information have been shared with the district attorney's office?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, it would not, unless, as Mr. Norris indicated, and this would not be likely, the defense attorney, for some reason, we're going to call that expert. Defense attorneys are only required to disclose, my understanding is, reports for any witness they intend to call as a witness.
Thank you.
Further questions?
One quick one?
Yes, Representative Promo.
How much does a DNA test cost?
I'm sorry, Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, for the contract that we have with Intermountain Forensic, which is at a reduced rate, it's $120 per test, is my understanding. For the private labs, prior to our contractor having the ability to do DNA, their hourly rates can run from $250 to $350 per hour.
But in this case, I understand it was a $729.
$729, and there was time on the phone with the defense attorney and other services billed.
In the explanation of the outcome of the test, explaining the outcome of the test and questions to the folks at the laboratory.
I should probably further explain, Chair Williams. We have with that contract forensic work, which is. Credited. They send us reports at $90 per hour. The DNA is at a higher, just a testing rate. So it was a combination of those two things.
Okay.
And then one more?
Representative Crummell.
Was the defendant's father also charged?
He's being charged in Harney County, Oregon, which is where he is. I know he has confessed, but goes back to the comment on we have access to the state hospitals. Gentlemen, no, we do not. The state hospital will not accept anybody for an evaluation now because of budget cuts. And so he is elderly, and Tim Callahan and I are both having the same problem. We cannot get them evaluated unless we pay for it with county resources. Same thing with the crime lab gentleman. I can't get drugs tested in the crime lab because they took a 66% reduction. Those are also crises that is going to affect both indigent defense and my office.
Right. Yeah, which we're very, very aware of.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks, Ann.
Thank you.
Okay. So State versus Cox. If you'd be sure to identify yourselves for the record.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dingle. I'm with the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I was one of the prosecutors in the Cox case. Mr. Cox was charged with aggravated murder, convicted and sentenced to death by a Marion County jury for stabbing a fellow inmate at the Oregon State Penitentiary. The purpose of my appearance today is to talk about the testimony of one of the defense witnesses, Dr. Cunningham, who appeared on behalf of the defendant in the penalty phase. As you well know, I have no idea actually how much Mr. Cunningham was paid. I did ask him on the stand during cross-examination. I think at that time he estimated that his bill would be somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. I'm in a somewhat unique situation with Dr. Cunningham because after the trial, one of the jurors contacted our office and asked if we could talk with them. The primary reason that they contacted us had nothing to do with Dr. Cunningham. He just had questions about the process. So we made an appointment and sat down with this person, and he asked us a number of questions of which are of no interest or concern to you. And then we asked him if he would answer some questions for us and told him he didn't have to. And so one of the questions we asked him was, what did you think about Dr. Cunningham's testimony and what weight, if any, did it have with the jury? And his response was a laugh and a chuckle and said that it had no weight whatsoever. They thought he was a joke. Now, as you've heard over and over again, when his name showed up on the witness list, I did not even approach my boss, Mr. Penn, about contacting an expert to deal with Mr. Cunningham. Our entire office budget in Marion County for all extraordinary expenses is $8,000 a year. That is photographs, that is witnesses that have to be brought in, that is calling a forensic psychologist to even consult on a case. We simply can't afford it. In a footnote, the Oregon State Hospital now charges us to do evaluations. So if we want to have, if even though we have a statutory right to have someone examined if someone raises a guilty but insane defense, we simply can't afford to do it. So I did what most prosecutors do in this case, which is I got on the telephone, found someone who had gathered a large number of transcripts. I could not afford to pay the postage to have the transcripts mailed, so instead I sent a law clerk to drive over to an adjacent county, pick up all the transcripts and articles that had been gathered to that point, drive them back to our office, photocopy them, and drive them back. And my response to Dr. Cunningham consisted of basically cross-examining and using the transcripts and information I'd learned from articles that I'd read about him. And that is, unfortunately, what we have to do in the vast majority of cases. We simply do not have the resources to respond to those kinds of experts. They show up on the list, and we do what we can do.
Before you begin your response, I guess I'm interested in can you explain to me, and I know it's in the material I'm looking here, it simply says that the doctor was paid somewhere, you think, about $20,000, and you had a juror who thought that his testimony was a joke. But can you be a little bit more specific for me? What was it that he was testifying? I mean, was this in the mitigation part of the case?
Yes, it was in the penalty phase. Right. Chairman Williams, yes, it was in the penalty phase. And what I found from reading all the transcripts is that it appears Dr. Cunningham has what I would describe as a traveling roadshow. He has a whole series of, I lost track of how many hundred overhead slides that basically, it doesn't have, a great majority of his presentation really has nothing to do with the individual defendant. It's starts on slide one and talks about the criminal justice system and then proceeds on. I think he actually testified for about 6 hours, and I know that defense counsel had talked to him at the end of the first afternoon by gauging the response of the jury and asked him to shorten it up because it was, I think in their belief, not being very effective. But in essence, that's what he says, is that people are less violent the older they get, and so this person won't present a danger in the future, is, I guess, a nutshell version of what he would say.
In your exception to the expense is simply that they were allowed to hire a mitigation expert, or the cost of the mitigation expert, or the fact that the juror thought it was a joke?
Well, it's sort of a combination of all three, Chairman Williams. You have a person, and you'll hear from people later, where I guess I understand if they want to bring someone in who examines the defendant and presents and offers an opinion. Now, when I do have that done, I know how much it costs the state. There are plenty of competent people in the state to do it. That runs anywhere, including their testimony, somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000, maybe $4,000. That's their examining the defendant, looking at the defendant's criminal history, consulting with me, and testifying. I'm hard pressed to understand why. And when I went through with Dr. Cunningham, he was more than a little evasive about his income. Because I had a series of transcripts of his testifying in a series of trials over the about 18 months. And I asked him the question, isn't it true that you derive a majority of your income testifying on behalf of capital murder defendants all over the country? He took exception with that, and then I proceeded to walk him through his income, because I think he tried to hold himself out as I'm really just a day-to-day clinical psychologist in Houston. And I think when we totaled it up, it came close to, it was almost $180,000 or $190,000 testifying in these cases. And his fees in those cases ranged from, I think the low was $7,000 or $8,000 all the way up to, I remember it was one in Colorado, it was a federal capital case where I think his bill ultimately was like $34,000. And the only reason those DAs in those states had that is because they had access to that information, and that information had been shared on down the line with regard to later prosecutors. They had the ability to actually get the bill, find out what it was, and then when someone would call them and say, Dr. Cunningham testified in your trial, how much did he get paid? They would say, well, his bill submitted to the state was this much money.
Okay. Why don't we allow Mr. Gorham now to make his response?
Thank you. I'm Steve Gorham. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm also the executive director, or part-time executive director, of a group called MCAD, the Marion County Association of Defenders. We're the exclusive indigent defense contractor in Marion County for everything but juvenile and mental commitments. I've given you written testimony, which I'm just going to be paraphrasing and talk about some of the issues that Mr. Dingell did. I also have provided you a opinion by Judge Dickey, which goes extensively into a different case, but talks about Dr. Cunningham and the case that you have the opinion on. I quoted a short paragraph of it, but if you have the chance to look through it, as well as Dr. Cunningham's affidavit, which I think you'll get later, you'll see his qualifications and his methodology in helping people, defendants in death penalty cases. It's extensive. A little bit of background. I've been doing extraordinary expense authorizations for Marion County Indigent Defense Work since 1991, when we started to do all the exclusive work. So, in essence, I'm Ann Christian in Marion County for extraordinary expenses. I would tell you that I was a Vista attorney for a year starting in 1975. I have been a criminal defense attorney since 1976. I've done numerous death penalty cases as well as a range of cases, so I think I'm an experienced criminal defense attorney. You could say, I think, accurately that I'm personally liberal, but those of you who know me know that I'm fiscally conservative. The state's money is my money. I don't consider it other people's money. It's my money. When on the very few times I'm out there using the state's money on my own, I'm going to McDonald's, not Alessandro's. I view the state's money as my own. One of the biggest things that I think Mr. Marquis's letter pointed out was accountability. And if you look at my written testimony, I think it's the second or third paragraph and the fourth paragraph, you'll see that in the criminal justice system, accountability, indigent defense funds are as accountable, if not more accountable, than any funds that you've ever seen. In Marion County, no one gets paid without some asking, first of all, for extraordinary expenses for pre-authorization. So they have to convince me that it's a reasonable and necessary fee. Then if they've convinced me of that, then they have to come back after the case and give a detailed time billing statement. Not only the extraordinary expenses, if it's an expert, they have to give a time billing so that we know every minute that they spent on our case, but also the attorneys do. So I know of no counterpart in the state prosecution system that accounts more than indigent defense, at least in Marion County. I think it's probably statewide as well. So if we're talking about accountability, the indigent defense system is accountable. And as you notice, once they're reviewed by me and they get reviewed by the Central Indigent Defense Office, and then they get potentially reviewed by audits by the Judicial Department auditors and the Secretary of State's auditors. So there is currently an immense amount of accountability, if you will. And I would submit, of course, like Ms. Christian has, anything that you all can help with accountability, we're certainly open to. Concerning the Cox case, these, as I've noted in my testimony, these are some of the most difficult cases. I mean, you have by definition somebody who potentially can get the death penalty. How, you as lawyers, how are you going to match the state's, not only their resources, which I've heard, you know, now maybe the state's resources are limited because everybody's resources are limited. But when the Cox case was tried, the state's resources were really not limited. If they wanted to go to the state hospital, and they probably did, although Mr. Dingell can tell us if he had any expert from the state hospital testify in that case, the crime lab at that point was freely available to them. And represented, I'm not good, you're good at this process, so I apologize, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, to answer your question before, do we have access to the state crime lab? The answer is, I think, sort of. Up until very recently, and there are problems with finances, they're state police officers. I have gone to the state crime lab on cases of mine, and I get the report and the information after the district attorney does. They are sworn officers who do this work, and they're reporting to, I think, obviously, their bosses, who are state police and the district attorney's offices, who aren't their bosses, but they get, in the cases that I've done and asked them for help, first of all, I'm told no, and then when I have brought up things like, well, they're supposed to be available to us and have gotten their help, I get the report after the DA gets it. So it's not a very good relationship, to at least at this time, to go and ask them for help. So I think you'll see, and I'll just stop here by reading Judge Dickey's opinion in the Smith case, where a death penalty was overturned, that it's extremely important in trying to fight the death penalty to have an expert, and frankly to have a nationally known expert. I don't disagree with Mr. Dingell when he says that it might be better to have the individual examined by that expert, and everybody has their own theory about which expert to use and how to use. But as you'll see by what Judge Dickey reviews as Dr. Cunningham's expertise and the knowledge that he can give a jury or a layperson about the death penalty issues and the four questions that are asked, this helps. It doesn't always help, and frankly, Mr. Dingell did a great job in cross-examining Dr. Cunningham. in this case. He obviously didn't come across very well, and probably is in response to the questions that Mr. Dingell was asking him. But in other cases, he has obviously helped.
Let me ask you a question again, Mr. Dingell. Did you use an expert in the mitigation phase of the case?
Well, in the penalty phase?
Yeah.
In this case, I was very lucky in that there had been performed a number of years prior a dangerous offender evaluation by a doctor who was working at the Oregon State Hospital. And let's just say I groveled and worked out an arrangement. He was here in Salem. He had to be here in Salem because he does evaluations for the parole board. And since he'd already done a dangerous offender evaluation, had already done the work back in 1991, basically what I did is I brought him on to testify about what he did in 1991.
Was he a state employee?
No, he's not a state employee. He has a private practice in Portland, but he contracts, I think, 2 days a week and performs, I don't know if they're dangerous offender, certain psychological evaluations for the Board of Parole.
Okay.
No.
It's all right if you don't recall the name. That's fine. Did he charge you for his time?
Yes, he charged us for his time, but it worked out to be an incredibly reduced rate. I think he ended up charging us like $150.
Okay.
Basically, but I want to emphasize that's only because he'd already done the evaluation in 1991. He basically got up and said, "I examined this person in 1991, determined them to be a dangerous offender."
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can also tell you that Dr. Cunningham charged less than $20,000 for his work.
Okay. Questions? Representative Parker.
Thank you. I agree. We certainly need all the defense in the capital cases. I was just wondering, you mentioned, besides the pre-screening that you do, and Ms. Christensen, which is great, I think, but you start talking about the needs are reviewed on down the line. Is that not after the case is concluded? They're looked at by the state auditors? I mean,
it is. First of all, if I might, while an expert can send in his bill or an attorney can send in their bill, they don't necessarily have to be paid unless I view their billings as reasonable and necessary. So that's the first review after the fact, and if I find a charge that's not reasonable and necessary, I cut it. I don't approve it.
Okay,
if that, I don't know that that answers.
The bigger one is after everything is concluded. So, for example, most of the capital cases, we can't find those out yet because they're still on appeal.
I think that's accurate. But I have given you at least general, if not relatively specific, for the three cases I'm here to testify to.
Thank you. And I didn't. The question you answered for me, I wasn't the one that asked that, but that's fine. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned, Mr. Gorm, that you're a taxpayer as well as a defender, and we are all taxpayers as well. And my question to you would be, we're struggling with how do we keep costs down. Could you or Mr. Dingell give me some ideas of ways that you think we could moderate the costs in some of these things and keep them maybe more level as to what the prosecutor and what the defender is spending?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm probably not going to give you a very good answer. Obviously, do away with the death penalty. There's a lot of expense in the death penalty, and I'd like to give you at least some of our quick statistics. In Marion County since 1991, where I've been keeping statistics, our average aggravated murder death penalty case has cost about $60,000 for attorney fees, $21,000 for expert fees or other than attorney fees, for a total of basically $81,000 average cost. In a regular, if there is such a thing, I apologize, regular murder case, our cost, average cost per case are $8,800 for attorney fees. The sub-providers are $4,600 for a total of around, the average is $13,400. So unfortunately, you can just see $80,000 versus $14,000 on an average, if there is ever an average case. So that's the best answer I could give you. we've heard the old system, if you will, was going to judges and asking judges for extraordinary expenses. I know, at least in my experience where I lived under that system, frankly, it was probably more expensive than the system now because I never had a judge refuse me, but I always had to go back and back and back and back and sometimes beg him for, I think, reasonable reasons for those costs. So I'm not able to give you a good, maybe another review would do it, but I'm not sure because I think things are pretty well reviewed now.
I'm going to give Mr. Dingell a chance also to respond to Representative Anderson's question, and then we're going to try to move on because we've got a lot still to get covered, and it's Friday afternoon. So, Mr. Dingell.
Chairman Williams, Representative Anderson, this is certainly no place to debate the death penalty, given the constraints the chair has placed on us.
Thank you very much.
And I expect that at the conclusion of the testimony, it's my understanding that the Lane County District Attorney, Doug Harkleroad, will be presenting a series of recommendations for the committee about how we can perhaps better review or rein in these costs.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next case, which is State versus Miles. And if we can, again, just keep ourselves focused on the issues of the extraordinary expense, I'd appreciate it. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Representative Williams, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Tuttle. I'm a prosecutor here in Marion County, and I have been for past 9.5 years. The first case I want to talk to you about today is the case of State versus Suzanne Miles. This was a woman who was living with her estranged husband. He was having an affair. They were headed for a divorce, and she was not happy about any of this. One day she went out and bought a gun. The next day she went to his office and she shot him, once in the head, once in the chest. Immediately after that, she went to the police department, turned herself in, and said, "I just shot my husband." This case was not a whodunit. This was not a how did it happen. This was not a question of why it happened. It was about as straightforward of a homicide as you can get. Despite that, it took us almost 2 years to get to the trial in this case. And the main reason for that delay was that the defense was exploring the Paxil defense. He wanted to put forth, I'm just going to say, the Paxil made me do it as the explanation. And he spent almost 2 years, about a year and a half, looking for an expert that would testify to that at trial. From the first time that he brought that up, both the judge and myself rolled our eyes at this because it seemed so unlikely that that was ever going to fly in court. I said from the beginning that I would be filing a motion to exclude that evidence if he were able to ever find an expert that would ever say this. And, in fact, that is what I ultimately did when he found that expert, as I said, a year and a half later. After, by the way, I think he had spoken with at least two other experts that turned him down on this. He had two major hurdles to overcome before he was going to get this expert to testify. The first was that this defendant was not, in fact, taking Paxil at the time of the homicide. There was evidence that she had her first Paxil prescription and her only Paxil prescription ever filled on January 13th of 2000. This was 6 weeks before she killed her husband. When we went through her prescriptions, we found that only 9 of the 60-pill prescription pills were missing. So she had only taken 9 of those. More important, her blood was tested. Her blood was taken on the night of the homicide. It was later tested by the crime lab, and there were no Paxil derivatives found in her system. Now, I will tell you that after she decided to go with this defense about a year or so later, she did come up with that she did take Paxil the night before, but all of the evidence in the case, but for her testimony, would contradict that. The second hurdle that the defense had to overcome was the fact that scientifically there was nothing to back him up on this. As Mr. Dingell explained, we don't have the resources in our office for me to go find an expert to contradict this. And instead, my job was to go and read the medical literature and find out what I could about this. What I discovered is that there are absolutely no peer-reviewed medical studies that support the contention that Paxil would increase somebody's propensity for violence or aggression, as the defense wanted the court to believe. In fact, all of the peer-reviewed studies available contradicted that. Paxil actually has the opposite effect. It is a mood-stabilizing drug, and it has the effect of making people less aggressive and less violent, and is often used for that reason. Again, this was pointed out to the defense for several times during the course of his search for an expert. He did finally find someone to come in and testify about this. That expert came into trial. We had a pretrial motion. The expert came in, testified, and the court threw that testimony out, excluded it from evidence at trial, and characterized it in a letter to counsel as quote-unquote junk science. I do not believe that this was a surprise to anybody. The key things about this, number one, certainly there was the unnecessary expense for the expert himself. Now, as I understand it from Mr. Gorham's letter, that expense turned out to be only about $2,000, which might not sound like a lot, but it was $2,000 more than what needed to be spent. But how much money was billed for this defense attorney's time in hunting down this expert? I would imagine he billed at least 100, well, I don't know how many hours, but countless hours for the time that he spent tracking down an expert. As I said, he mentioned to us in conversations with the judge that he had spoken with a couple of other experts that had turned him down. He had spent time doing internet research. He had read a book about this. He'd done a variety of things. Maybe he didn't bill his time. I don't know, but I doubt it. The other problems with the delay, as far as our county is concerned, of course, we have the delay of having a defendant in our jail that we're paying for every single day. This was a defendant that really needed to be moved on to the Department of Corrections. There was certainly my time. My time, of course, is free. I have my regular caseload, and then the time I spend on this on nights and weekends is not paid overtime. It's my own time. So I guess in terms of cost to you, that's non-existent, but of course it is a cost to me. The court time was taken. In this particular case, we had another issue, and that was that the defendant and the victim had a child together. There was a 4-year-old little girl. The victim's mother wanted custody of this little girl and was trying to get that. The dependency proceedings, or the proceedings that were in existence to decide where this little girl would go, could not be concluded until our criminal case was done. And so that portion of the case was delayed for 2 years. One of the biggest problems of this for the victim's family was that the mother of the victim who wanted to adopt this child lived in Virginia, and so she had to pay her own expenses to fly out for dependency hearings, to come to our trial, and so on for that 2-year period of time. So there, it was family upheaval, but significant amount of costs all around for this search for an expert that we all knew from the beginning wasn't going to go anywhere.
Okay, Mr. Gorham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did review the attorney's fees and expert fees in this case. I did not try the case, so some of the details I don't know, but some of the details I'm going to respond from Mr. Geiger's memorandum that he did review. Concerning the blood and that she didn't or did not have Paxil in her blood, this is a quote out of Mr. Geiger's response to the state's motion in limine, which he lost. In fact, the defendant does not have any toxicology reports indicating the blood or urine was ever tested for the presence of Paxil metabolites. In a phone conversation with Ken Manili on a certain date, Mr. Manili explained that there was not enough urine left to test for Paxil and that the blood would not yield accurate results because it was too long after the ingestion of Paxil for there to be any metabolites. So I'm assuming by that it was not tested for Paxil, so we're talking about it was and it didn't have any in it, that may not be an accurate statement.
Mr. Chair, I think just for the record, Mr. Manili is a lab person with the state,
yes.
For those who don't know.
Yes, I apologize. As you all know, in every crime in the state of Oregon, or almost every crime, there is both an act and a mental element to the crime. So this was obviously not a whodunit, that's the act. The question is, what was the defendant thinking about at the time? It shouldn't surprise anybody here, since the common defense for husband and wife killings or wife-husband killings is extreme emotional disturbance. That's what it was originally made for, is this type of defense, and that was one of the defenses that Mr. Geiger was looking into. I don't know how many experts Mr. Geiger contacted, because the only expert that was charged to the state was the expert that took the stand and was not allowed eventually to testify, and his cost was under $2,000. So if he did contact others, which he probably did, they didn't charge the state of Oregon anything. And I'm sure it's correct that Mr. Geiger, I don't know anybody in this room, maybe you all do know a lot about Paxil, I don't, and he was appointed to represent this individual. It was certainly a valid defense to explore, and he had to learn about it. So there, I'm sure, are hours that he spent learning about it, and I think those, at least some of that time was detailed in his memorandum that the state did receive, because the memorandum went to the court. He, in his response to the motion to in limine, had basically several pages about what Paxil does or doesn't do to someone's thinking when they're taking it. I would submit to you it was a valid defense. It was in the scheme and relatively a minimal expense, and the judge did what the judge is supposed to do, decide based on the state's motions whether it should go in front of the jury. This case is up on appeal. Either the judge was correct or he wasn't.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
First of all, I won't allow to go uncommented on the irony of hearing it. The case involving the shooting of a spouse on Valentine's Day.
The point wasn't lost to me either, Representative McPherson.
In any event, a more serious aspect of this, I would be interested in hearing a comment from both of the witnesses about whether we should be expecting that there would be some parity in the amount of expense invested in the prosecution and the defense of a case, and would that be any different if it's a capital case as opposed to a non-capital case?
I can give you my opinion, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. I would love parity, because if you look at all the costs, I am convinced that this prosecution has much more resources than the defense in almost every, certainly in the average case, and probably even if you don't look at the average. Now, death penalty may be a little bit different in the death penalty cases, because, as I said, in defending a death penalty case, the overwhelming, I think, public feeling is that that individual should get the death penalty for an intentional homicide. And you need the expertise that the defense needs, the expertise. And maybe the defense needs a little bit more resources because of that.
Chairman Williams, Representative McPherson, I guess I think that they're going to find across the board that the state and the defense are going to disagree on who has more resources in this. I certainly know that as a prosecutor, I know that my hands are often tied, and I cannot do things that I would like to do, whereas on the other side, I see things that are done that I wish I could have done. I don't know, as far as parity is concerned, I don't think it would be right for us to have a dollar-for-dollar accounting in every case and so that each side spends the exact amount of money. I think, more importantly, the focus needs to be on keeping it reasonable on both sides. And so and I'm sure that Mr. Hawko will address this more, but I think that would be the better focus.
Council had a question, then I'm going to go to Representative Anderson, and then we're going to move on. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Gorham, let's assume that in this situation the defendant went to her attorney and said, I was on Paxil, and because of that I was very emotional and could not think straight. And let's say that he said to her, that's not valid. Okay? He doesn't raise a defense. He doesn't bring it in a motion in limine before the judge. She's convicted. Is this an issue she could bring up in post-conviction?
Mr. Chair, counsel, absolutely.
And Mr. Chair, and what would be the grounds?
That the defense attorney did not zealously represent the defendant and was ineffective.
And if the Court of Appeals agreed with her, what would be the result?
Have to retry the case.
Thanks.
Representative, excuse me, Chairman Williams, if I could respond briefly to that. Mr. Taylor, I want to correct one thing. That this defendant's blood and urine were both tested. The urine was screened for the common street drugs that we see, and it was marijuana that was in her system at the time she did this homicide. The blood was tested as well, and my understanding of what Mr. Manili was saying was that we didn't have enough blood to do a second test, but that had there been Paxil in her system, it would have been screened out on the first test. I think that's important for what you're asking, because defendants will often, I'm sorry to say, they will lie, and they will say things that their lawyers have to deal with them with and say, hey, the evidence is flying in the face of what you're telling me. I'm not saying they don't need to explore it, but again, when we talk about what is reasonable, I don't think it is reasonable to take everything a defendant says at face value, especially when evidence flies in its face.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that a case could be brought back on appeal if the defendant does not have the money or the expenses were not there to defend he or she correctly. I guess my question is to you, have you knowledge of cases where the judges award an appeal to the district attorney or the prosecutor where you have not had sufficient funds to really defend the way you'd like to?
Chairman Williams, Representative Anderson, unfortunately, I don't get that option. The appellate rights are with the defendant. If I lose the case, the case is done, and that's it. I don't get a second chance at it.
Thank you.
That is that sort of burden of proof thing we have still in our system. Okay. I'm going to exercise the chair's prerogative because of our time, and we're going to not do State versus Hamilton. We have both the description of the issue and we have the response from Mr. Gorham. It in many ways tracks similarly the issues that we talked about in State versus Hamilton. And in the interest of time, we're going to skip that one. I notice that Mr. Marquis is back in the room, so we'll back up onto the agenda if he's ready to talk about State versus Garner. I want to give him that opportunity since we didn't get to it yesterday. And then we'll see where we are at that point. I'm going to ask if we can all just try to be brief, because I want to give a full opportunity for Mr. Harkelrode and Mr. Shepard to talk to the committee before we start to break up here. So, Mr. Marquis, are you ready on State versus Garner?
Mr. Cross was an able opponent in that
case. Okay. So you'll start out, and then we'll hear from Mr. Cross.
Yeah. One preliminary matter, and I'll keep this very brief. Yesterday when I testified, I received copies of letters from Mr. Fay and Ms. Longo. I read them as I was here. One of Ms. Longo's letter was faxed to my office yesterday at about 11:30. I would ask permission, given that they are part of the record of an important proceeding, that I be given the opportunity to supplement the record by responding to them. They, frankly, went beyond just the discussion and made some statements that I concerned that I don't want to burden the committee with at this time, but I would like the opportunity to respond.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate you not wanting to talk about them now, and we will keep the record of the proceeding open, and we'll put anything into the record that people want to respond to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I won't reintroduce myself because I'm sure
everybody... Leave the record, if you would.
Oh, okay. My name is Joshua Marquis.
Thanks.
I am the district attorney for Clatsop County, Oregon, and have been since 1994. I've been a prosecutor for 20 years and did indigent capital work for about 18 months. The last case about which I wanted to bring to the attention of the committee is the case of State versus Anthony Scott Garner. Mr. Garner, in 1998, we had some discussion about the crime because his co-defendant was Mr. Simpkins, who Mr. Fahey was here yesterday talking about. This is the same investigation that Mr. Fahey described as, quote, the most sloppy and unprofessional he had ever seen in his career. That sloppy and unprofessional investigation resulted in Anthony Scott Garner's conviction on aggravated murder charges and the jury sentencing him to life without parole. And I won't go over the basic facts because I'm sure most of the committee remember it. Two men were accused of stabbing a woman to death on board a boat. Mr. Garner was clearly the primary actor. Mr. Garner not only participated in the murder, we believe primarily committed the murder, but also then set fire to the boat while police were trying to talk him off, incinerating most of the evidence. The defense was conducted by Mr. Cross and Catherine Correll, and they were assisted by a number of investigators, and forgive me for being a little disorganized. And I want to stress, as I did yesterday, that When I'm bringing up a particular case, I'm responding to the chairman's request to be specific about concerns about excesses. I think Mr. Cross and his co-counsel did a good job. I have, again, no idea how much money their legal fees were. Probably they earned every dime of it. And the issues that caused me concern are ones that were, again, simply obvious through cross-examination. Since this case is under appeal, neither I nor you nor the press have any ability to examine this. There were three issues that jumped out that I listed in my letter to the committee on the 28th or 29th of January. The first dealt with a psychologist who was called, and my recollection is his name was Jose Solis, but Lacalle, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of another doctor. He was a psychologist from California who advertised extensively on the Internet, which is where I was able to do most of my research about him, and specializes a cross-cultural psychologist. And Mr. McCabe gave you some pretty extensive reasons why in some cases that might be necessary. I would point out in this case that the defendant was white, the victim was white. They were of European ethnicity, and there were no cultural issues that I was aware of. This witness produced a large amount of material, and when I cross-examined him, most of his material was most of his notes were completely unreadable. Maybe that's a problem with doctors, I don't know. But when I asked him on the witness stand, no offense, Dr. Anderson, I asked him how much money he had charged. He indicated that he had billed at that point at least $30,000, which is twice the amount that I have for all witnesses in 1,200 cases that my office administers in the course of a year. Another witness who testified was the defendant had been in prison for manslaughter in Washington before. It was one of the bases on which we were seeking the death penalty. This is the second time he'd killed somebody. He was a very intelligent guy, and he had formed a lot of relationships, including one with a teacher who I believe had worked at one of the prisons in Washington. She was originally listed by Mr. Cross as a character witness, but apparently became engaged actually as an expert witness because she also held some sort of psychology degree. Again, I have no idea how much she was paid, and the only thing that came up, and again, it may seem de minimis, but it goes to the issue, was that Judge Brownhill, who is the trial judge, had some ability to review the request for indigent expenses. And at one point, outside the presence of the jury, I'm sure Mr. Cross remembers it, she very sharply examined this witness about her travel expenses, which included, if I remember correct, a box of Godiva chocolates, which was charged at some airport that she was traveling through. And my impression, and again, Judge, you have to understand, the trial judge is looking at a document that I don't have the ability to look at, and she just clearly was irked by it, and I believe took counsel back into chambers ex parte and discussed with them that particular expenditure. Again, you know, the indigent defense budget is not going to be broken by a box of Godiva chocolates, but it's that sort of, and then the $30,000 sort of offsets that. The other thing that went on in this case that was significant was that the case took place in 1998. The trial didn't take place until 2001. That was largely because challenges to the master jury list. Many challenges like this have been filed. The defense was essentially successful in getting the master jury list. But Judge Brownhill was very clear that it was on the condition, for the reasons I talked about yesterday, in a community our size, that individual jurors not be contacted. You can't contact 500 or 600 people in Clatsop County without affecting the case. Judge Brownhill did grant limited access, and the defense retained a professor from Portland State who, if I recall correctly, about 2 or 3 weeks before the trial showed up. Again, I have no idea how much he was paid, and said he couldn't possibly analyze the data unless he talked to individual veneer men and women, jurors, potential jurors. Judge Brownhill said, it's not happening, and as far as I know, that was sort of the end of that. So those are the issues that came up in the Garner case. There were many other witnesses that testified, and I'm only bringing to this committee's the attention of the things that clearly struck me as unreasonable and beyond the pale.
Okay. We will ask Mr. Cross to respond.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Cross. I'm an attorney in private practice. I practice criminal law, and I have a contract with the Indigent Defense Services to provide representation to persons accused of aggravated murder. I was lead counsel for Mr. Garner, and I would, and Dr. LeCaille is in fact holds himself out and is one of the primary or premier experts in the country on cross-cultural issues. But he's also one of the most experienced forensic psychologists in the United States, particularly in capital work. He has been involved in capital litigation as an expert for both the state and the defense throughout the United States, and not merely on issues involving Hispanic people. He's a diplomat in forensic psychological circles. Dr. LeCaille did testify about his fee. At the time of trial, it was, I believe he said he had billed at just over $30,000. And I'd like to point out to you that that fee was double what it had to be. We did not receive a witness list from the state for the sentencing phase or the penalty phase in this matter until trial had begun. The initial list included over 90 people. Judge Brownhill inquired and said, and basically didn't ask, she said, you're not going to call 90 people, and instructed the prosecution to provide a culled list. Even on that list of 90 people, I'm going to back up just a little bit. Earlier it was asked whether the defense has access to the materials that the prosecution has discovered in its investigation, and that is required by both constitutional law and statute. And in this case, we received over 3,000 pages of discovery. Much of it had to do with Mr. Garner's prior prison records. He had been convicted of a vehicular homicide in 1980 in Washington. When we took this case, and after reviewing it and seeing Mr. Garner talking with him and looking for experts that would help us on the case, we were, both my co-counsel, Kathleen Carell, and I, were aware that this was what we would term a true death case. By that I mean that Mr. Garner was a candidate for the death penalty, and our experts, like Dr. LeCaille, who have been involved in capital litigation for decades, told us that if you go to penalty phase, you're in trouble. That's one of the big reasons that we sought the best experts we could find. One of the reasons we wanted Dr. LeCaille, had absolutely nothing to do with cultural issues. We wanted him because of his expertise as a clinical psychologist with the forensic background that he had. Because we needed to explain to this jury reasons why they should not take the life of a man who, as an indication of how he appeared, he was about 6 foot six, 350 pounds. And every time he took the stand, Judge Brownhill moved the water pitcher from one end of, from close to him to the other end of her desk. He was an imposing and rather scary individual. We also employed a number of other experts. We employed an addictionologist who presently heads the professional recovery program for the Betty Ford Clinic in California. We also had Dr. Craig Haney, who is probably the foremost expert on future dangerousness in the United States. Among those materials that we received from the prosecution was approximately 1,500 pages of prison records and reports on disciplinary problems and things like that. Our experts were given those records to go through, and they were given basically carte blanche to Mr. Garner. We urged Mr. Garner to talk about everything that he could talk about that was in these records, which was basically everything. When we got the first witness list, we discovered that virtually none of the Washington State Corrections personnel were on that list. And when we got the second list, we noticed it had been culled by about half. On that list were three witnesses that we were somewhat stumped by. One was young Bobby Miller, who was listed as a prosecution witness.
I'm just going to ask you to bring us back to the issues of the extraordinary expenses that were raised.
I understand, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Miller was killed in the accident in 1980. Two other witnesses were supposed a victim and a witness to a very violent assault by Anthony Scott Garner. But if you looked at the police reports, that Anthony Scott Garner was black. Our Anthony Scott Garner was white. One of the things that you have to do because of reciprocal discovery is we must turn over all of the notes of our experts to the prosecution so that they can do the same thing we do, review and prepare. Judge Brownhill ordered us to do so, and we found ourselves in a complete conundrum. Because if we turned over those notes, we provided to the prosecution a roadmap to penalty phase that they obviously had not prepared. And so we went to the court in an ex parte on the record conference with Judge Brownhill and explained our dilemma. And the judge allowed us to withdraw the witnesses that we were planning on calling and seek other witnesses. Dr. Kaye was a fill-in for Dr. Craig Haney, and his bill basically doubled as a result because he spent hours meeting with traveling to and meeting with Dr. Haney and with our mitigation expert in order to bring himself up to speed on an issue that he was aware of but had never testified on before, so that we could present to the jury the evidence on future dangerousness that was absolutely essential for adequate representation. We had that problem throughout, and it increased the costs for special expenses, I would guess, by doubling them. Dr. Eirich was, in fact, first called as a character witness. She had known Mr. Garner after he had been released from prison and for that vehicular homicide. And we were forced to call upon her to provide information that we could no longer use because of the conundrum that we found ourselves in. And Dr. Eirich, at the last minute, cleared her calendar and spent a good bit of time coming into Clatsop County so that she could talk with Mr. Garner, bring herself up to date on who he was and what he'd done, and so that she could testify about matters that we would have hoped other witnesses who were who'd been involved in the case in the 3 years that it took to go to trial and had more expertise. And yes, she did bill for a box of chocolates in the Portland airport. She's allowed $30 a day for per diems. Because of her schedule and the way we were racing her around, she hadn't eaten that day. And her per diems for that day for meals was one box of Godiva chocolates bought at the airport. When we explained that to Judge Brownhill, she appreciated that this was not an extreme abuse of the system. But nonetheless, we told Dr. Eirich that she would have to pay for that $5 box of chocolates herself.
And I'll just point out to the committee, and this will be available as well. We received by an email today, which will be put into the record as well, an email from Kathleen Correll, who was also, I think, involved in the case.
She was co-counsel.
And it's just a copy of a letter that she, a letter to the editor on the chocolate issue that she submitted to the Oregonian. So that's available as well. I just want to point that out. So
the third aspect has to do with the case taking 3 years to go to trial on the jury issue. We were the first, this was the first case in Oregon where the court ruled in our favor and ordered the state court administrator's office to turn over these master jury lists. Very briefly, this is a very complex issue, but very briefly, one of the reasons we were curious is because when they combined the lists, the initial list from which the master list is drawn, we had more people, by about 10,000 more people than lived in Clatsop County. This troubled us as to what kind of procedures were going on to select the jury panel. The case was in the Supreme Court on mandamus by the state, and the Supreme Court took a little over 18 months to reach a decision in that case upholding Judge Brownhill. We then returned to the trial court after having the and some time passed before the state actually turned over the computer disks containing this information. And as Mr. Marquis has indicated, Judge Brownhill ruled that we could not randomly question anyone in the jury pool. I may be wrong about this, but I believe that Ms. Correll and I decided not to file mandamus on that. The case had taken 3 years to get to that stage. We were only months before trial at that point, and we went through the trial.
Mr. Chairman, may I briefly respond?
Yes, briefly.
I know counsel didn't mean to, when he says that the state appealed, actually it was the state court administrator, actually, not the district attorney's office. Right. In fact, at one point, the case was dragging on so long, I said, give it up, just let's get to trial. So, I've heard complaints about not getting enough discovery, but this is the first time I've heard about getting too much discovery. And counsel has named several witnesses who, like Dr. Haney, I didn't complain about. We had a number of other expert witnesses that we prepared for who were not called, and that happens. I don't think that's necessarily an abuse. The only issue I raised was that there was, Mr. Cross is a competent lawyer, and as he says, this was a case in which death was a risk. He had an inmate who had been in prison for 10 years for manslaughter and committed a horrible crime and had a huge prison record. There was not a question of hiding the ball of where either party was going in this case.
Okay. Any other questions about this case, Representative Barker?
Real briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cross, you mentioned about the discovery and how you provide things, and I'm not certainly not saying you're trying to hide anything or doing anything wrong at all, but it seems to me, I mean, just to point out, you were talking about suddenly in your work you discover you're giving the other side a roadmap, and so you stop. And I understand that's your constitutional obligation. But conversely, if Mr. Marquis had come up with any exculpatory evidence against your client, he would have to turn that over. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, that is correct. The ethical obligations of prosecution and defense are quite different. And for good reason, I'd
say. Okay, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We have a couple of more case names on the list. I'm looking. We're gonna miss Hamilton. The lawyers involving Davis aren't here. That leaves us the Lloyd and the Barone case. Do we have people on both those cases in the room, Ms. Christian?
I'm just here with regard to the expenses.
With the expenses, how about from the prosecution side? Is there people here on those cases?
Sorry, which
cases? The State versus Lloyd and the Barone case are on the list. And he's still in the meeting. Here's what I think we're going to do. To the extent that people want to submit written materials on either of those two cases, I'd encourage people to do so. I really want to turn our attention at this point to bringing on Mr. Harkelrode and Mr. Shepard talking a little bit about where we go from here. So if you've got written materials, submit them to the committee and they'll be distributed. And anything that can be submitted in writing. You guys are out practicing your script. I expected to see a whole bunch of people holding signs sort of standing in the back of the room.
We have figured all this out.
Yeah, good, good. Welcome to both of you. If you'd identify yourselves for the record, please.
Sure. I'm Doug Harkelrode, Chair Williams, the district attorney in Lane County, and representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association today. And I'm actually angling for an opportunity to do a skit on the floor of the House, if you could arrange that. I'm just kidding.
All you have to do, Doug, is get elected.
Yeah.
We do skits on the floor all the time.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Ackerman and I can take care of that. We can have him up as our guest for the intro of the session on the day.
Can you sing?
No.
Oh, all right, just check.
My colleague with me could introduce himself, but this is Ross Shepard, the public defender in Lane County.
Thank you, Doug.
For many years. We decided I was going to go first, so here we go. Chair Williams and members of the committee, I think there's a fundamental policy issue that underlies what you've heard, but which has not been stated. And that underlying policy issue, which causes, frankly, a conflict, is whether or not we will have a constitutionally adequate indigent defense system, or whether we will have something better than that. The lawyers who represent the defendants on an appointed basis and otherwise would say, I want to zealously represent my client, that's my job ethically, and I want to do a good job. which may be much more than constitutionally adequate. So the policy decision for the legislature is, do we do constitutionally adequate indigent defense, or do we do something better than that? So you have to decide that. Now, whether you say we're going to do what's constitutionally required or we're going to have a higher standard than that, you have to have fiscal accountability. That's absolutely critical. Because we're spending taxpayers' money. The new commission that starts on July 1, Peter Ozan and company, should have written guidelines for indigent defense funding. And I haven't thought that through completely, but an example would be, we will bring no out-of-state experts to testify unless there are no in-state experts available that are qualified to do the work. Hourly rates for experts could be established as guidelines, whether it's $90 an hour for a psychologist, $150 for a psychiatrist. But you could work through that and come up with some guidelines for what we're willing to pay through that commission for the experts in the indigent defense area. The system that I'm most familiar with, of course, is Lane County. And there we have an indigent defense provider, where what happens there is, and Ross could describe this in great detail, but what happens there is the same thing that happens in our office. If his lawyers want to bring an out-of-state witness, they have to talk to him about it. Why is it necessary? How much will it cost? How long will they be here? Where are they going to stay? That also happens in my office. And sometimes we say, there must be a better way. There must be a cheaper way. Can we get by doing something less? So I like having an indigent defense provider that is not an hourly basis provider. The statute right now on indigent defense and disclosure, or lack thereof, and that's ORS 135.055, sub 3, sub A, says that the person or the counsel for the person may, upon written request, which shall not be disclosed to the district attorney prior to conclusion of the case. It's interesting that it looks like only the DA doesn't get the information, but everybody else in the world could, although I don't think that's the way the statute's been interpreted. That is interpreted to mean after all the appeals have run. I would suggest to you to change that to when the trial is over with and the defendant has been found either not guilty or guilty, or when they have pled guilty and been sentenced. And the reason for that is that now is immediately then available for scrutiny by victims, by victim advocates, by prosecutors. They get to look at that stuff. And Ross has pointed out to me that there might be some confidential communication issues in there, and we'd need to deal with that without a doubt. But that would sort of put the public light on that. That's the way it is in the DA's office. We have a budget, and every budget year we look at as much detail as the line items. As a practical matter, on large cases, I tell our secretary, start a cost bill so I can identify exactly what those costs are. And if somebody asks me, I can give them, I can say, here's what it is. Here's what we spent. Yeah. One suggestion, or another suggestion, would be that the new commission, when they go to negotiate contracts, around the 36 counties, if they actually negotiate contracts, they should talk to the DAs, and I think the DAs would be willing to say, here are how I charge, my charging practices. And they do vary somewhat from place to place. So build a contract that is consistent with the charging practices. To give you an example in that area, some places on fugitives where we're bringing somebody back from out of state, they actually have hearings in court and they require more. We believe that that statute doesn't require a hearing in court, and if we can get a waiver at the jail, so much the better. So they should, but my point is how much should you pay for that representation? And it depends on how much work it is. So they ought to check with us on our charging practices. Do we charge two burglaries when there's 20 and then try to deal the whole package, or do we charge all 20? Different DAs do different things. The last thing I would tell you is that hopefully there is a significant savings if you decide on the what I'll call the lower standard, the constitutionally adequate defense. And with guidelines and screening and peer review, by the way, did I miss peer review? Okay, yeah. If you can do all of that, then I think you ought to raise that hourly rate for those people who work on an hourly rate basis, because $40 an hour doesn't do more than cover their overhead, and it ought to go up to some level. But I know that's hard to do in these economic times, so you got to save the money first before you do that. But they should be paid more than that. That's all I have.
Okay, Ross.
Chairman Williams and members of the committee, it is my observation that the conclusion that you should draw from these 2 days of testimony is that there clearly is no systematic pattern or practice of abuse in the use of extraordinary expense funds in this state. You've heard testimony about cases that are almost 20 years old and or go back 20 years. During that period of time, the Indigent Defense Services Division of our government has processed over 2 million cases. And it's my observation that actually they've done a very, very good job of trying to keep the costs down. There are going to be, we're all human, there are going to be individual cases that we're going to have differences of opinion on. And those are perhaps the 11 you've heard here, but my analysis of these 11 is that they're none of them will clearly and convincingly persuade you that there was an abuse in even that individual case. I think that perhaps what we've heard here on the part of the district attorneys is a lament that they do not have adequate resources, and that may very well be the case. And perhaps that's the issue that the committee should think about addressing. In fact, do approve the extraordinary expenses and for my office, not for all of Lane County, but the cases that I see that might be viewed as abusive are requests by young attorneys that would come to me and ask for a psychiatric examination of a defendant just because the attorney didn't know what else to do. It didn't appear there was anything else to do for this client, so I better get some sort of medical evaluation into the file so when this case is on appeal, the appeal wouldn't be successful, but when the case is on post-conviction review, it will look like I did something for this client rather than nothing. So the attorney is really just sort of watching out for, prospectively, for that attorney's own welfare, either to defend against a complaint to the Oregon State Bar, which are very frequent in this practice of the law, or in litigation on post-conviction relief. So the attorneys we have learned that we had better watch out for what's to happen later in the case. I would suggest to you that the committee not consider a statute at this time. The Public Defense Commission will take over in either July or October, and you'll deal with that date, I expect, pretty quickly. The commission should set its own standards and its own method of review. It seems to me that peer review should be built in there. experienced attorneys giving other attorneys, be they experienced or not, advice on the proper expenditure of funds can be extremely helpful and might be actually provide guidance that the attorney requesting the funds hadn't even thought of. So probably that's a cost-effective way of doing it, and I suspect that the commission will adopt something along those lines. My last comment is congruent with my colleagues. $40 an hour is not enough to do this work. Most of the work is not done in the state by lawyers on an hourly basis anymore. It's only, I think, 5 or 6 or 7%. I'm afraid that some of the cases that might raise questions about extraordinary expenses do come from the hourly attorneys rather than the contract attorneys. Thank you.
Thank you. Doug, I got your comment about the changing of 19205, which I think is the statute you referred to as the one that seals the record while the case is pending on appeal. Am I right about that?
I thought it was ORS 135055, sub 3A.
It might be. Maybe we're looking at something different, but I think the subject matter is the same.
Okay.
And it's a comment that I was reading this case, the State of Oregon versus Cunningham, where the Court of Appeals talks about the concept of a substantial right, and they say access to indigent defense records could provide a prosecutor a significant tactical advantage if a defendant's conviction is reversed on appeal and he is subjected to a retrial. From such records, the prosecutor could determine that defenses had been explored, why they had not been pursued, and similar things. We agree with the defendant that a, quote, substantial right, close quote, is involved. I was interested in your comment about that, because if you're asking us to look at that issue from a statutory standpoint, we've also got to look at the fact that the Court of Appeals at least has called something a substantial right, and whether or not substantial right in quotes in a Court of Appeals case means something beyond a statutory right, I don't know. But I would tend to wonder if they would view that as something that, frankly, even if we were to change the statute, they might argue has such an impact on the ability of somebody's defense if the matter were to come back on retrial that it would go beyond our statutory ability. Do you have a comment about that?
I do.
I'd like to hear it.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that we disclose confidential information in that amount, but we can certainly disclose the dollars and cents that they're spending, and probably in general categories as well, and still comply with that that statute, or not statute, but that case. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be some work in there, and as I mentioned in my comments earlier, Chair Williams, members of the committee, we need to make sure we don't run afoul of that sort of thing. But I can tell you, without a doubt, that if we don't shed public light on the spending of public money in the hundreds of millions of dollars, that there will be people who have anecdotal stories that they read it in the newspaper or they heard about it, and why in the world did they get to have this cultural anthropologist, or why did they get to have this survey for millions of dollars? Thousands of dollars, and that will continue, and I think we don't want that to continue. So somehow we need to disclose what we're doing.
Well, and I think
public money.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we've had these hearings, frankly, is to try to get beyond the issue of anecdote to the issue of system and how the system operates. And I think that's going to be an issue with suggestions that you've made in the comments of Mr. Shepard and working with Mr. Ozan and the new members of the commission and with the information that Ms. Christian has provided us to see if we can, in a constructive way, sort of move us off of discussing indigent defense almost entirely about this particular issue and get to the broader subject. And I think we appreciate both of your involvement in helping us get there. I want to give other members of the committee an opportunity to comment. I also have promised Ann an opportunity to answer some questions of the committee, and I didn't do that before I brought you two up. So I'm going to come on up to the table, Ann, and after we get done with some questions, we'll let you make a couple of comments as well. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think your last comments highlight what the tension is, I think, about this in terms of public dollars in this case. Now, transparency is what we talk about when we talk about spending public dollars. We want to know how those dollars are being spent. We want to know what they're going for. We want that full accountability. In this case, it's just a weird kind of system where you've got public dollars being spent for something that is constitutionally protected, in many cases confidential right, which is the right to defense and the right to a fair trial. I mean, that's just weird. I mean, if you look at it in terms of how we typically approach public spending, in this case, I say that's just that tension of public dollars going into a function that is kind of the sanctum sanctorum in legal circles, that confidential relationship and the constitutional right to prepare and defend for a trial. I'm sure we can probably better balance that, but I think that really is partly what's the heart of this, that tension between public dollars and private rights here. And I think the other thing, just in comment, and then I'll be done, is that, you know, I agree. I don't think I've heard anything here that suggests to me that there is that there's any kind of rampant or even regular abuse of the system. But I think we do have here a situation that we're going to see in every sector of the budget, and that is things that in good times might be mere irritants, in times of downward budgets become just fractures, things that you can kind of look the other way and accept in good times you just can't. And I think what we've got here is, frankly, insufficient spending for district attorneys and for prosecution. And we see that declining, but I'm not sure that the way to resolve that is by reducing spending on the defense side. I think, you know, you don't achieve, that's the wrong way to achieve parity. It seems to me the way to achieve parity is to bring the resources for the prosecution up to a level that they can do their job. I don't think we do the public safety much good by basically shackling both sides to something that may not even be adequate in terms of your ability to perform your public responsibility and the defense side's ability to perform their constitutional responsibility. I think that there ain't nothing here that money won't cure. And I think it's more money into the system, truly, to equalize and to provide parity rather than to be reducing spending on the defense side.
Further comment, Representative Barker?
Just very briefly, and I do agree that people in your field and in the judges in the legal system are grossly underpaid in Oregon. And I've noticed that the district attorney in Portland, Mike Trunk, has testified and asked for increased funds for indigent defense attorneys because they need to have more money there by the hour or however their contract. On the question about the looking into this thing after the trial, Mr. Shepard, could you see a process where that might work if there were enough safeguards to protect that? You know, we can't violate the Constitution, but let me tell you why I'm asking that and why I think it would be good if we could. Because even when times are good or bad, if the public, you know, I hear all these stories about the bad lawyers and on, and there's joke books about lawyers. People probably like you less than they do the legislature, which is saying something. But
Representative Barker, remember the committee that you're sitting on.
As a non-lawyer, I said that. But I think it would be helpful if there was some way so that it isn't like for 20 years we're hearing the anecdotal stories that may be totally incorrect and could be easily cleared up. If there's safeguards to protect the Constitution.
If we can avoid the disclosure of confidences or secrets, or avoid the disclosure of the attorney work product, then I think that could be accomplished. That would take some work. I don't think it's impossible, though.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just as a follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
Do you think that would be a good idea if we could do that?
I don't think I'm the one to ask,
okay.
Frankly.
Okay.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just have just a couple of comments. I don't think it's coincidental that the examples we've seen over the past 2 days occurred in places other than Lane County. I want to say that there are many, many non-monetary considerations that come into play here, and one is basically how well a district attorney's office is administered. I can say that my experience in Lane County, particularly with District Attorney Harkleroad, that you and your deputies exceed the constitutional standard of adequacy as far as providing information to defense counsel. From what I have seen here over the past 2 days, a lot of our breakdowns result when the adversarial process gets out of whack and we have overzealous prosecution and overprotective defense. I think if we can find ways to deal with those non-monetary types of problems, we can save the system some money.
Okay. Further comments? Representative Crummell, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple of different questions, and you can choose to answer these now, or if you want to take them down and then provide written answers later, that would be fine. With regards to the contracts, is there a master contract for indigent defense lawyers, and then are those contracts hourly or capitated? With regards to, there was something I read in the material that made the charge that the prosecutors have use of Oregon State Police, the FBI, the AG's office, U.S. Attorney's Office, the Oregon State Police Crime Lab, state medical examiners, and other agencies. And I'm just curious, first of all, is that true? And second of all, what other, who's been left out of the list? What other agencies would there be? And then why would contractors, and this gets into the audit report, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'm curious as to why contractors would refuse to give auditors requested information when it was asked in that 94 audit. And then this one goes back to you again, Ann, I think, is did you or anybody in the office follow up on any of the recommendations that were from the audit report in 1994?
And here's what I'm going to do in the interest of time, and I'm going to ask you to respond offline to Representative Crummell on the issues of contract management, capitation issues, questions with respect to the audit report, since we really are wanting to focus on the extraordinary expense issue. But I would like Mr. Shepard, Mr. Harkleroad, to respond to his question again about this issue, it's been an interesting dialogue to hear the discussion between both the prosecutors and the defense lawyers about who's got the better opportunity to get to resources, and you know, how do you break that up? If either of you have thoughts about that, share with Representative Crummell. I'd like you to do that.
Well, Chairman Williams, Representative Crummell. Yes, in theory, the prosecution has all of those other governmental agencies there as backup and as help. There probably are some services such as psychiatric medical examinations that wouldn't come within the United States Attorney's Office, by example, that they would have to go outside. But I think in theory and in good budgetary times, they do have all of those resources.
Chair Williams, sir, Representative Crummell. I agree with Representative Shetterly about there's not enough resource for the DAs to do their job. Independently, Mr. Shepard and I came to the same conclusion after hearing these cases. Just out in the hall when Ross and I were talking about this, he said, you know, it looks like the DAs don't have adequate resources in these cases. And that was my reaction when I heard Mike Whitney, who I've worked with in the past in Lane County, is investigating a case over on the coast that's a murder where the police haven't gone out and contacted a bunch of witnesses. My reaction was, where was the major crime team from the state police to do that case? Because small police agencies, they don't get murders very often. We have one in Oak Ridge right now. It's a pending case where, fortunately, they did what we asked them to do. They called us. And we responded with a very senior lawyer and got some deputy sheriffs up there and took care of them. But they couldn't have done it by themselves, not because they don't work hard, but they're not good people, but they don't do that investigation. So I agree with that. Now,
in theory, we have every one of those agencies you mentioned available to us. The question is at what level and how often. And so the FBI, I can't call the FBI and ask them to do anything. They occasionally bring a case to our office when the U.S. Attorney's Office has declined to prosecute it, and they want some prosecution on it, so they bring it to us. But I don't pick up the phone and call the FBI and say, hey, I need your jet, or I need two guys over here today. Will they respond to the Springfield shooting case where we've got 26 kids injured, two dead? Sure, they'll come on over and they'll take some assignments on that. Will they respond to the rape case down in a not too good a neighborhood in the Eugene area? No, they won't do that. So it sounds better than it is.
Well, I want to, Ann, give you a couple seconds to respond. Or a couple of seconds maybe is too short, Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate that. And I will address the questions from yesterday, which I think were exclusively from Representative Krummel. I've written up some answers. I'll include those as well as the answers to the questions that really come out of that audit report since 94. And the bottom line is we do have the answers. But I did pass out because it's disturbed me greatly through the course of these hearings. I do really appreciate the hearings. It's disturbed me greatly the extent to which the concentration has been on the fact that this information is the information with regard to actual cost of cases with regard to indigent defense is not available. Mr. Chair, you are correct. There is the Cunningham decision from the Court of Appeals, and there also are other policy reasons not to disclose actual billings, and I look forward to people looking at that issue. But from day one that I have been in this office, which would be 1988, when faced with a situation where the trial of the matter is over, regardless of the result, whether it's acquittal or whether it's a finding of guilty, a sentence of death, so the continuum, we have always, upon request of the public, the press, prosecution, provided a report similar to what I've handed out today. Now, it does not list specifically information about individual investigators or that type, but it's just, I think, as Mr. Harcourt perhaps was suggesting, is something that we've already been doing by general categories. And you can see, for example, in the Yancey case, which recently, that's part of the reason I brought Yancey, it's only 2 months old. And we expended, the state of Oregon, the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, expended a grand total of $200,000 in this case. So I indicated to Bob Coons yesterday that he and I needed to speak because this information is available. And you'll note that when Mr. Marquis sent his facts with regard to the Manzo Hernandez case and also Baroni and those Washington County cases, the information that we provided to Mr. Caleb from a phone call last week, he called my office and he talked to one of my staff and he said, Lori, when the Manzo Hernandez case, Lori is my staff person, when the Manzo Hernandez case was over and it was middle 90s, he said, you sent me something that had the general cost. Can you send it to me again? We sent it, and within a day, it was sent to you. So what I would say is I think there are times where communication with everyone is critical, and so I am very thankful that you have had these hearings, and I think many of Mr. Harcourt and Ross Shepard's suggestions are good, and you have a commission and an executive director who will do a very good job.
Thank you, Ann. And I want to take a moment to thank everyone for participating in these hearings. I know it hasn't been everyone's idea of fun for the last 2 days, but I think it's been a valuable exercise to discuss these issues and to have a full and a frank and open dialogue about them. I think we'll take the recommendations made by Mr. Harcourt and Mr. Shepard under advisement. We'll intend to work with both of you, and want to thank the District Attorney's Association for responding to the request, and also to the Indigent Defense Services Division for doing the same and providing the information. And as I mentioned in Mr. Marquis's testimony, we'll keep the record open. So if there are other formal responses that people want to put on the record in these cases, we're happy to do that. The committee, in parts and generally, I think, is interested in trying to assist in bringing this part of this issue to resolution in some way or another, so we can move on to focus on some other issues that are obviously confronting us within the general area of indigent defense funding. I do want to circle back just briefly to the comment that you made, Mr. Harkelrod, at the beginning of your comments about the policy choice that we have to make, which I think is a really important way to define the question that you asked. We do have a constitutional obligation, and the issue is, to a great degree, what is constitutionally adequate defense? And it's a very, very difficult question, and frankly, we can shoot at that target, knowing full well that the Oregon Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court will be the ones ultimately to tell us whether we hit it or not. But I think it's an important question to have. I also think it's an important question to keep in mind, in my own view, that we don't want a double standard system of justice in this state either. And we want to make sure that while we're providing a constitutionally adequate defense, that we're also providing a system of defense that whether or not you're a poor person or a wealthy person in this state, you receive a defense that in fact is going to be a necessary and constitutionally adequate defense. And somewhere in that mix of those balances, we're going to have to figure this out as best we can. And I want to give you guys any last shot at a comment or a statement if you need one.
I don't need it.
All right, good. With that, then, we'll adjourn the hearing. Thank you, everyone.